Hello, insiders, and welcome back to Inside Tracks Hour 2. Wishing you a very pleasant good afternoon to you, wherever you may be. This is Captain Bob Wells coming to you live from the luxurious Essential Pest Control Studios located in the KVOI broadcast complex here in Tucson, Arizona. Welcoming you to our special National Security and 9/11 Patriots Week edition of Inside Track. Producer Tom continues running the board and taking your calls for our second hour, and we invite our questions or comments for our guest at 520-790-2040, which are relevant to the topic. Before we get to our special guest, it is important to pause and remember the sacrifices just recalled this week of the American people as we honor the memory of 9/11 attacks on the Twin Towers in New York City, the Pentagon, and Flight 93. We will never forget, and we have a responsibility to remind our citizens and the new generation, some that were yet born in 2000, of that tragic day and the need to protect our nation and to be vigilant against those that would do us harm. Our very special guest this afternoon for the second hour is Navy Commander and Enduring Freedom Veteran Kirk Lippold. Kirk served as a former commanding officer of the USS Cole, DDG 67, attacked by Al-Qaeda while refueling in Aden Port in October 2000. Captain Kirk, I love saying that. Thanks for joining us today. Welcome to Inside Track, sir.
Thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure to be on the show with you.
Great. And to our listeners, Captain Kirk is a special leader in the Naval Service and has a very important lesson to really convey to us all here in Southern Arizona and also in the United States, as this show will also be part of the podcast. It'll be on Apple. So, Kirk, in a split second, as you recall back on that October day in 2000, your ship was refueling in Aden Harbor. Your life, the lives of your crew and your warship did change. Can you describe what was that change to you as your ship was attacked? What were your first thoughts, sir?
Sure, Bob. Well, that morning, USS Cole pulled in to take on what we estimated was about a 250,000-plus gallons of fuel. We were halfway. We'd been operating in the Mediterranean. We were headed to the Middle East to go to the North Arabian Gulf to do what we call visit board search and seizure operations, enforcing United Nations sanctions against the country of Iraq. But where Aden, Yemen sits at the southwest corner of the Arabian Peninsula, it's halfway between the Mediterranean and the Middle East. We pulled in for what we thought was going to be a routine refueling operation that morning, expected to be there at least 6 to 8 hours, taking on fuel at about a 3 to 500 gallon per minute rate. We pulled in that morning around 8:30, turned the ship around in the harbor, my first force protection decision, to make sure we were pointed bow out so that if we needed to get underway in a hurry, we could. Moored the ship out starboard side to a pier out in the middle of the harbor, and we shut down our four main engines that power the shafts, kept two of our three gas turbine generators running, started the import refueling checklist that morning about 10:30. We started taking on fuel, and the clock started. We had been as part of routine operations that morning. We contracted for three garbage barges to come out to the ship to take off trash, hazardous material, plastics, you know, the things that we normally can't dump at sea. And my main post and assistant had brought the import refueling checklist off. I verified the items, signed off on it. We were pumping fuel that morning. My executive officer had come up with the supply officer, and we actually determined that we were taking on fuel at a much faster rate than we expected. Instead of that 300 to 500 gallons a minute, it was actually 2,500 gallons a minute. We were overpressurizing the fuel tanks and had to bring the rate down to about 2,000 gallons a minute. What that did for us, though, was collapse that timeline from 6 to 8 hours down to 2 to 2.5 hours. We were ready to feed the noon meal of chicken fajitas. I said, let's start cycling the crew through. That way, about the time we finish feeding the crew lunch is about the time that we get the ship set to get underway, and everything would be hunky-dory, and we could get back out to see where Navy ships feel safer and belong. During this time, we had had two garbage barges come out to the ship, one to the middle of the ship, one to the back of the ship. They had actually loaded up with all that trash, had left, and were halfway across the harbor when a third boat came out, slowed, turned by the bow, came down the side of the ship, came right to the middle of the ship, and at 11:18 in the morning, our lives changed forever. There was a thunderous explosion. You could feel the entire 505 feet and 8,400 tons of guided missile destroyer suddenly and violently thrust up and to the right toward the pier. We seemed to hang for a second, slid back down in the water, rocking from side to side, searching fore and aft on the mooring lines. I had literally come up in the brace position, grabbing the underside of my desk while standing on the balls of my feet as everything popped up about a foot, slammed back down. Power failed, lights went out, ceiling tiles popped out. When the ship stopped moving to a point that I could let go, literally, Bob, the first thing I did was say, okay, you know you've had a major fuel explosion. Now what you're going to need to do is, no matter what happens, no matter what your crew tells you from this point forward, you as the captain have to stay absolutely calm. You need to be able to focus on what they're telling you and start making decisions. I went to the door of my cabin. A young officer standing there looks at me, and we both watched as this gray cloud comes down the passageway and silently washes over me. I could smell the dust. I could smell the fuel, but there was this acrid metallic tang that settled in the back of my mouth, and I didn't know what it was. This young officer looks at me, using good sailor-like language, asks me, what the F was that? Then he goes, fuel. Thinking like everyone else in that split second that we had had that major fuel explosion. And what does he do? The same thing those young men and women do today and were trained to do. He headed into that smoke toward the danger to find out what was going on. I took one step out of my cabin to follow him and stopped. And in that split second, I knew we had been attacked. Because if it had been a fuel explosion, either on the ship or the pier, because we were starboard side or right side to the pier, if anything, the force of that explosion would have blown us left and out into the harbor. Instead, I'd been shoved up and to the right. Mm-hmm. The only thing on the port side or left side of the ship was open harbor water, so instinctively I knew something had come alongside, detonated. I went back into my darkened cabin and back into my bedroom area, and similar to when you had command of your ships, right near the head of my bed, on the deck or the floor, is a safe that kept all the keys to the weapon systems on the ship. Mm-hmm. Missiles, torpedo, 5-inch gun, 20-millimeter close-in weapon system. I knelt down with a light shining, emergency light shining on the dial, dialed it open. I reach in. I don't grab a handful of keys. I brought a personal weapon with me, Sig Sauer 229 9mm. I grabbed three clips of ammunition, loaded one, chambered around, decocked it, put the other two clips into my pocket, out of my cabin, ran to the middle of the ship. As I was standing there, I'm watching dirty black water dripping off the superstructure. Wires that used to form a high-frequency radio antenna are snapped off and draped down. And as I look around, I don't know whether we're going to be boarded. I don't know whether there's going to be a follow-on attack. But I took that deep breath and said, well, this may be your destiny. But if you're going to go down, you're going to go down fighting for your ship. And you take that deep breath, and I headed toward the port side, and all I could think to myself is, if you see someone that doesn't belong, make them duck first, but don't leave an empty round in the chamber. Fortunately, the first person I saw was my chief gunner's mate, responding with his security teams to reestablish the defensive perimeter around the ship. We talked to each other, leaned over, and at that point, my worst fears were confirmed. You could see the hole in the side, and all the metal was shoved inward. You could see the spray pattern of explosive residue on the side of the ship. The lifelines had been blown away in that area. So we clearly knew at that point that we were under attack.
And your sailors were just about going to sea to tail, and they were concluding their lunch down there. And your sailors took the brunt of that blast, did they not?
Absolutely. Where the blast hit was in the middle of the ship. It's right where the mess line is, where the crew had lined up to get lunch. It's at the widest part of the ship. And once Once I knew what had happened, I left the chief in charge, told him, you know, the common sense thing. Don't allow any more boats alongside. I went into the darkened ship and up to the bridge. I contacted the Yemeni Port Authority on the radio. I asked them for three things. First, since we didn't know where the attack had come from, freeze all harbor movements. They agreed. Two, notify the local hospital. They said they actually had two hospitals and would get ambulances down to the pier by harbor control to meet the wounded when they came ashore. But I had no way to get my boats in the water because they're on the starboard side of the ship, now pinned between the ship and the pier, and there's no way I could lower them. So I had to ask for them to send boats out, and they agreed to do that. But I told them, do not come any closer than 100 meters to my port side. Make an arc around the stern of the ship and come to the back of the refueling pier, and we will get the wounded down to you. They agreed to do all those things, and then once they did, USS Cole at this point is in trouble, because when I had arrived on the bridge, my operations officer is up there, my navigator is up there, two senior chiefs, but already USS Cole was listing over 5.5 degrees to port, wow, down 1 degree by the bow, and we could literally feel our ship sinking beneath our feet. So I went down in the dark, started walking toward the back end of the ship. And the interior of these destroyers, there's a passageway on both the port and starboard side near the skin of the ship that essentially run the length of the ship, and three passageways that bisect it. And near each of those passageways, running from the port to the starboard side, are the lockers or the closets that contain all of our damage control equipment. That's all the equipment that you use for fighting fires or mm-hmm. flooding, or in our case, that explosion. So as I start walking down the starboard side toward the back end of the ship to find out what's gone on, I got my first piece of good news. Because as I look toward the back end of USS Cole, there are lights on in the back one-third. Right then and there, I know if I've got lights on, I've got a generator running, which means mm-hmm. I can get power to pumps, which means I can now save the ship. But, you know, you mentioned the crew. When I get to that middle passageway, it's just a wall of metal because, as I mentioned, it hit at the widest portion of the ship, which was 66 feet. Damage extended across 60 of the 66 feet. Wow. Had crushed one of my three repair lockers shut so nobody could use. So I'm down one-third on damage control. But already, this is what happened with the crew. Once that blast went off, believe it or not, the announcing system for the ship was knocked offline. The backup system failed, and the battery backups for both had failed. So there was no way to tell the crew what had happened, where to go, what to do. But we had invested a lot in our training. Mm-hmm. And without even anyone telling them what to do, they immediately divided into one of three groups. Damage control to save the ship, triage to save their wounded shipmates, or security to stop another attack. And at that point in time, I knew that we were going to be able to save USS Cole.
How many hours were you and the crew at it before the ship was stable?
We were able to get the ship stable in a little over an hour. When I had initially arrived in that midships area, I was finally able to work my way through the damaged metal, and I was literally standing in what was the chow line, the mess line passageway, looking down into what was left of main engine room number one. You could see the hole out the side of the ship. You could smell fuel and lots of it. We estimated that the Yemenis kept pumping fuel on the ship at about that 2,000 gallon per minute rate for 5 to 7 minutes after the blast, before they finally shut the valve down on the pier. And coupled with the cracked fuel tanks, we leaked well over 60,000 gallons of fuel into Aden Harbor that day. But as I'm fond of saying, you know, look, I owe everyone an apology, because we as a nation have made the decision to go green. But in that particular moment, Bob, I did not pause to fill out the EPA spill report. Just some things you got to let go in a moment like this, and that was going to be one of them.
In a moment like this as well. And again, we're going to have to go to break, Kirk, as I'm sure All of our listeners are on the edge of their seat. We're talking with Kurt Lippold, the former commanding officer of USS Cole, attacked by Al-Qaeda while refueling in Aden Port in October 2000. For all the listeners, it was less than a year from 9/11, and all those particular elements of Al-Qaeda's planning, the intelligence community, the things that Kirk has learned since his command in that tragic day. We're going to talk about that when we come back. This is Inside Track.
Jamie Kipper and her father, Gary Kipper, from Tucson Iron and Metal. What are they going to see when they come through the gates?
So when they come on in, they'll see our building up front. People have free rein to then go out and look in the yard. So it's not a typical scrapyard with a ton of big machinery. We have a couple of forklifts around, but that's about it, just to help move material. So when you come in, it's all organized by material, whether it's square tubing, angle iron, roofing, and then there is a pile in the back, which is still organized and easy to get through, but that's stuff that comes over from the scrap. So we're unique in that we get stuff in from the scrap, which a lot of artists and people will like or reuse, whether it's a sink that someone needs for their house. We sell literally anything made of metal.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up with science.
You mean you don't use a shoe?
No, we use the latest in technology and innovation to eliminate bugs, termites, weeds, and more.
No spray cans and lighters?
None of that. Only solutions that target insect biology, using chemistry to help protect the environment, people, and their pets.
Huh. Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up. Call 886-3029 or visit EssentialPest.com.
It is the year 2178. Earth is no more. The greatest fears have taken place. An alien ship from the Andromeda Galaxy have discovered the dark planet and sent in a team to unearth what life might have been like.
What have you found? Your Excellency, we found images on a strip of celluloid of what these humans were like. We present this to you.
Quiet.
I see a violent people. No wonder they cease to exist. What else did you find? This must have been their mode of transportation. It is what they refer to as an automobile. Does it function? We shall show you. Any information? There is evidence. It was maintained at Perfection Auto Works, 1046 North Beverly in Tucson, Arizona. Interesting. Evidence that not everyone of Earth was a stooge.
As long as Earth is still here, have your car maintained at Perfection Auto Works for out-of-this-world service. 323-8650 and perfectionautoworks.com.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. When people turn 50, something miraculous happens. They start to get serious about retirement planning. They've done very well so far and want to be certain they power into the retirement they've earned. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's
777-1911. We're back on Inside Track with our very special guest, Navy Commander and Enduring Freedom Veteran Kirk Lippold, the former commanding officer of the USS Cole. Kirk, yeah, you've just explained over the last few minutes the split second. As your ship was refueling in Aden Harbor, that the lives of your crew and your warship changed. And I think it really resonates, especially historically, as you were mentioning, you were between the Med and the Middle East, you were heading out, and it was a routine, you know, port visit for fuel and garbage and so forth. And this is October 2000, but I think in your mind, based on your briefings, you also recalled the 1996 Khobar Towers incident where we lost lives inside of Saudi Arabia, also the embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. You know, force protection was on your mind to protect your crew when you're alongside. And one of the lessons, I think, that comes out of this as you have learned over this last 23 years, is that we didn't connect the dots when you were heading in there. And most likely, as the lessons learned had become public, there were indications that Al-Qaeda was active there in Aden Port. And from your professional perspective and from what you've learned, and you're a man that is known as somebody that's going to tell the truth. You know, what did our Navy and our in particular our U.S. country team miss? And I'm saying this here because this is where the service gets into our inside track listeners, because we've got quite a few veterans, intelligence personnel, soft political leaders representing Arizona here in the greater area. And I think this is an important line of communication that you can convey to them from your professional experience. So what did we miss? How did we not connect the dots now that you know what you know after your ship's attack?
Absolutely, Bob. I'm gonna tie up from the last segment to answer a question that I didn't quickly get to like I should have. And that was, we were able to get the ship stable in a little over an hour. And that first day, we evacuated 33 wounded off the ship in 99 minutes. Wow. And of those 33, 32 would survive. And over the next couple of days, we had five people that showed up with ruptured eardrums, and that's where we had the total of 37. And ultimately, it would be 17 killed. But when I was in the Mediterranean, I was required to submit my force protection plan. But we did not know what pier we were going to go to, what side we were going to moor to, or what boats were going to come out to us, what refueling hoses. So what did I do as a lean forward kind of guy? I submitted my force protection plan, and of the 63 measures, I said, I'm going to do every single one of them. And it went up the chain of command to the battle group commander on board the aircraft carrier, Abraham Lincoln, who approved it as written. Then it went to Fifth Fleet headquarters, who approved it as written. What I didn't know that they did know is that I was going to be at a pier out in the middle of the harbor, and that over half the security measures wouldn't even apply to my geographic circumstances. Oh. Like, I don't have to monitor vehicles coming down the pier when you're at a pier out in the middle of the harbor, for example. So force protection back then was somewhat taken as a perfunctory administrative thing, and it was rubber stamped without people thinking it through. What the Navy learned as a result of that is that when it comes to force protection, you need to really stand back and say, okay, let's ask the hard question. For every force protection measure that's out there, and for your listeners, this still applies today. So when you look at them, okay, for every force protection measure, tell me what the procedures are that you need to follow to do that measure. What is the equipment that you need to have to do that measure? Now that you've got procedures and equipment, what's the training that you need to give your people to make sure that they understand how to follow the procedures, use the equipment, do it properly? And what are the rules of engagement that will allow you to be able to do that particular measure? And the driver over all of this that really hits home there in Arizona, especially for Fort Huachuca, is going to be, what is the intelligence driver that is pushing you or directing that commander to have to follow that force protection measure? And if those commanders don't have that information, demand it from your chain of command. Otherwise, don't pull into a port. Don't land your aircraft. Don't put your troops in hazard's way with force protection measures that are being told that you have to follow, but you don't know why. You don't understand the background. Now, occasionally, all of us are going to have to push that I believe button. But coming out of this, I think there was a lot more awareness giving to force protection plans and what each of those measures are that we are requiring people to follow and how we have to actually implement and do them. Because if you don't, there can be tragic consequences.
Well, from your perspective, and getting back to the force protection and the intelligence drivers, and I really like that key point you just made. Because of the culture with the intelligence community, sometimes you're not going to be able to understand or to get those intelligence drivers. And those things need to get to the commanders. They need to get to the leadership so that you can prepare your force protection measures. So you're sort of put in a a catch-22 circumstance here. So
to a degree, yes, you are, but if you don't ask, you aren't going to get the answer. You know, sometimes we're told, hey, whether you like it or not, shut up and color within the lines and do as you're told. And as a commander, you have to somewhat balance what you're seeing for the intelligence picture and what you're getting. To give you another example that I learned over time following the attack on my ship, and this was literally years afterwards, is that in any country in the world where we bring our ships, who's the lead guy for intelligence for that country? It's the CIA station chief who is at the embassy and liaisons directly with the ambassador. Well, what was happening back then is that what I didn't know when I pulled in that morning, I was the 27th ship to pull into Aden to get fuel. The program had been going on for about 2 years and had been started under General Zinni, who was the Central Command commander at the time. Mm-hmm. At my time, it had just become General Franks. And they had been pulling Navy ships in there because it was a great place to operate. It sits astride some of the most strategic sea lanes in the world with the goods and oil going up through the Red Sea and feeding the underbelly of Europe. You also have piracy operations going on in the Horn of Africa. So it was a very strategically located port, and we wanted to engage with the Yemenis to be able to use it. But at the time I pulled in, there were literally zero assets in Aden keeping an eye on what was going on. So when the Navy Criminal Investigative Service, or NCIS, would normally show up to do what they call a port vulnerability assessment, where would they go? They'd check in at the embassy and the agency and all the folks working there from the defense attaché and the station chief would say, everything is good. You don't need to worry about anything. We have no indications of anything going bad in Aden, when in fact, Al-Qaeda had been in that port for a year. They had been watching what Navy ships pull in, what pier they go to, what side they moor to, what boats come out. And I know that in a lot of news reports, you saw that it was a Zodiac boat that raced across the harbor and rammed the side of the ship and detonated. That is absolutely false. Al-Qaeda, about a year before my attack, had brought a boat in that looked just like the garbage barges that come out to the ship. 24 foot long, center console, outboard motor, two guys. And the two boats that we had loaded up with trash that left, when that third boat came out, it slowed, turned by the bow. My young fireman up on the bow, as the boat had gone by, had thought to himself, something's not right. Next thing he knew, the boat had gone to the middle of the ship, detonated, and he was knocked flat on his back with a face full of shrapnel, survived. And when the FBI and NCIS interviewed him at Portsmouth Naval Hospital, what he had thought to himself as that boat went by was, boy, that sure is awful clean for a garbage barge.
So Al-Qaeda was really watching, as you said, that for that year ahead. Wasn't there another U.S. Navy ship that was also targeted before
there was.
USS Cole?
When the FBI and NCIS went there, and you got to remember, the Yemenis don't have to exactly follow laws like we do. They knew who a lot of the Al-Qaeda sympathizers and Al-Qaeda members were in Aden. They just rounded them up, threw them in jail, and said, let us know when you want to talk. So when the FBI and NCIS showed up, several of them talked, and what they found out was that there had been a similar attempt at an attack in January of 2000 when another Navy destroyer, USS the Sullivans, was at the same pier we would be at. That morning, though, it was windy. There were choppy seas. They had loaded the boat with explosives. Before they could even get it off the hook, it started foundering and taking on water. They disconnected the hook and it sunk. Al-Qaeda scrambled, left the area, determined within about 24, 48 hours that no one had detected it. They came back and they recovered the car, the trailer, the boat, the explosives, which they tested in the desert. They moved to a new safe house, and when it came out to us, the explosives, which was a combination of both TNT and plastic explosive that was like C4, interleaved, had been built into the boat, covered with a red carpet, and you couldn't even see it. So there had been an attempt at an attack. The intelligence community never detected it. And consequently, when we pulled in that morning, we were totally unaware that when we pulled in under threat condition, which are now called force protection conditions, back then threat condition Bravo, it was actually a threat condition Delta port, meaning attack was imminent.
I've been in the threat condition, threat con Delta ports during Enduring Freedom in my command, the USS Lake Champlain after 9/11. Getting back to the key points you're making, though, these intelligence drivers, you really need to have dedicated people who are thinking about their customers, their ships, their armed forces that are coming into their theater for logistics. In your case, the refueling in Aden Port. Have we gotten better, you know, from your perspective? Again, this is the 9/11 week. The USS Cole is a prominent tragic event that was on the road to 9/11. But have we gotten in better in connecting the dots? The intelligence drivers still need to support, you know, the armed services, the people that are out there right now, or are we more complacent just because there's so much information?
Well, I think, Bob, that initially after the attack on my ship, we were very vigilant. Clearly, mm-hmm. after 9/11, we were even more vigilant. But as time goes on, as you know, that old saying comes into play that familiarity breeds contempt. And the familiarity of not having this style of attack occur over the last 22 plus years certainly is lending, at least for the Navy, mm-hmm. all of the lessons learned when they said these are the things we're going to take out of USS Cole. They were applied, and as the years have gone by, now none of them are actually implemented. The only one that's really even out there to a degree is that we now train for the waterborne threat against ships while they are in port. The one thing that I would commend your listeners to think about, though, is that, you know, when it comes to the intelligence community, something that's often underestimated is that these analysts that are out there, they take huge amounts of information, they review it, and depending on sources and methods that it comes from, they turn it into intelligence. Then they have to have that ability, and the leadership needs to give them the time they need to analyze. That means they need time to take all those disparate dots that you talked about and discern if there's a pattern. And that you need to give them the time to just think. You know, a lot of times people say, well, they don't look like they're busy. They're not doing anything. You know, sometimes these analysts just need time to think to do their best work. And when you give them that time, that's how you can begin to connect the dots. That's how you can begin to discern a pattern. That's how you can begin to detect that there is, in fact, you can't quite figure it out. But then you call in more experienced people and say, hey, there's something here, but I can't quite discern what it is. But it's not normal. It's not routine. There's something changing. And I think that the intelligence community, while they still try hard, you got to remember, they're like the Department of Homeland Security and TSA. They live in a zero-defect environment. As long as things don't go south and go bad, they're doing a good job. But the minute something happens, everyone expected perfection. But in fact, we'll never be able to achieve that. What we want to do is try and minimize those times when we do get caught short. Well, and, that's where I think we work hard, but we're still kind of getting away from that a little bit.
Well, DHS has been vigilant, and the Customs and Border Protection, especially with this Arizona, you know, border circumstance with interdicting terrorists, affiliated people that are coming from, that have affiliation with ISIS and have affiliation with other terrorist groups in the world. So your message is resonating, I think, with regard to the need to continue to give the analysts more time. I think listening to some of the testimony on the Hill with regard to what do you need, it's always been intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, to support a better, you know, operational understanding or an understanding of what the threat is. So,
sure. Bob, the one thing that I would point out is that what you're seeing with the southern border mm-hmm. is somewhat what happened to USS Cole. There had been a number of precursor events leading up to USS Cole. As you mentioned, there was There was World Trade Center 1 in 93, yes. Khobar Towers in 96. There was the embassy bombings in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, Nairobi, Kenya in 1998. Those were attacks against things that housed and represented U.S. interests. The attack on USS Cole was fundamentally different because now al-Qaeda was trying to take away our nation's ability to defend those interests. And when you do that, it's an act of war. When you look today at what the drug cartels are doing, they've killed Americans. They're flooding our country full of drugs. They are sitting there and having no action taken by the U.S. government except for, God love them, the DEA and what they're trying to do in fighting what is an uphill battle, because we essentially have an open border by the current administration that is allowing all this to occur. The problem with doing that is when you do nothing, like they did in response to Khobar Towers and the embassy bombings and everything else, you'll end up with the USS Cole. And that's my greatest fear, is that we are setting our nation's citizens up for failure. Now, granted, drugs have killed over 100,000 Americans, and it has barely looked as a blip on the radar scope because the media doesn't want to really report that these drug cartels, aided and abetted by the Chinese providing the precursor chemicals, are waging war against the American people. And we need, as a nation, to wake up and start looking and realizing what the threat of an open border means for our country in total, because we don't know who's coming across. We don't know fully who's gotten into our country. We already know that we have been intercepted, known terrorists trying to get in. But who's gotten in that we don't even know about? And that is the million-dollar question that I think puts just a dagger of fear into the heart of the intelligence community, because they're not allowed to really detect who we have here.
Those are important observations, Kirk, and we're going to ponder that as we go to our next break here. And we're going to come back with Kirk Lippold, the former commanding officer of USS Cole, in Aden Harbor. And you know, our first segment talked about national security with China, Russia, Iran, North Korea. They seem to get all the headlines, but this particular area of terrorism, counterterrorism, and the Middle East. We're going to be talking with Kirk Lippold about the Middle East since he was in Aden, and asking him the key question, is the Middle East still important? This is Inside Track. Thank you.
I'm proud to welcome my good friends at Tucson Iron and Metal Retail to Inside Track as an advertiser. Jamie Kipper and her staff are conservation experts. They sell round and square steel tubing, metal plate and roofing materials, as well as new and used steel, aluminum, and stainless steel to ranchers, artists, interior designers, roofers, and do-it-yourselfers, just like all of the listeners here. Tucson Iron and Metal Retail is open Monday through Fridays, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., and Saturdays, 8 a.m. to noon. Tucson Iron and Steel Retail, 701 East 36th Street. Call 520-209-1576 or go to TucsonIronRetail.com. And when you do call, mention this ad and receive an additional 10% discount on their already great prices.
Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up with science.
You mean you don't use a shoe?
No, we use the latest in technology and innovation to eliminate bugs, termites, weeds, and more.
No spray cans and lighters?
None of that. Only solutions that target insect biology, using chemistry to help protect the environment, people, and their pets.
Huh. Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up. Call 886-3029 or visit EssentialPest.com.
Smooth takeoff. Always thankful for the crew.
You doing okay today?
I had to skip breakfast. A little hungry.
Copy that. I got your back.
Where's he going?
Hi, can I take your order?
Yeah, I'll take two double chubby chucks, two fries, and two double chocolate shakes to go, of course.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Colonel, I'm back.
That was fast, Captain.
Fast food.
All right, the question is, how are you going to get my order to me?
Through the probe and drogue.
But, Captain, that's what they use for refueling.
That's exactly what I'm doing.
Thanks, Captain. I got it. It's still warm. Let me tell you, I owe you.
Well, sir, you're invited to the barbecue this weekend and bring a prime rib.
No problem, Captain. I'll see you Sunday, and God bless the USA.
At Perfection Auto Works, we appreciate and honor those that give themselves to protect our freedom. From your F-16 to your F-150, 323-8650 and PerfectionAutoWorks.com.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. Some people view market declines as a time to panic. Good news, that's wrong. Markets have never gone down and then failed to come back to create new highs, and this time it's not different. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call Eb Wilkinson at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
We're back with our very special guest, Commander Kirk Lippold, Captain Kirk, who served as a former commanding officer of the USS Cole, attacked by Al-Qaeda while refueling in Aden Port in October 2000 on the road to the 9/11 attacks. And Kirk has provided us all, and we're very appreciative of his insight and his leadership and the importance of protecting your crew and the importance of protecting our country. And the example of the USS Cole is really resonating here during our discussion. We just concluded with a couple points on the border, the importance of not knowing who has come into our country, and looking at terrorism is still a very potent national security, homeland security threat to our citizens, just like it was on the road to 9/11. So, previously mentioned that China, Russia, Iran, North Korea seem to get all the headlines, Kirk. But from your perspective, knowing where this terrorist intent comes from, in your judgment, is the Middle East still important? Are we, paraphrasing Daniel Yergin, taking our eyes off the prize?
The Middle East is important now, and it is going to be as important in the future, even though the world is making a transition, regardless of where you sit politically on the climate change issue. I think people realize that the transition to more green energy sources is going to be a good thing. But the world is going to remain dependent on petroleum products and fuel from the Middle East for the foreseeable future. And consequently, this is why the Middle East is going to continue to be a very strategic linchpin for any nation that understands that it is the most effective energy source out there. So the Middle East, while it does have its issues, we're starting to see a lot of progress being made. But when you look, China, no doubt, is the number one enemy against the United States. I should say adversary, but I use that term a little loosely. But at the end of the day, look at what terrorism does. Terrorism achieved its objectives with the numerous attacks culminating in the 9/11 attacks. And that was, it forced our nation to nowadays having spent well over $1 trillion for a new department, the Department of Homeland Security, the Transportation Security Administration, all those things that went with us. Because of the psychological impact. Did 9/11 itself really have an impact on our nation? No. It took down the Twin Towers. It damaged several other buildings. It put a hole in the side of the Pentagon and a hole in a field in Pennsylvania, and tragically cost initially just shy of 3,000 lives. But with the after effects from all the dust and everything, it's cost thousands of lives more. But at the end of the day, it wasn't like Pearl Harbor. There was a decapitating strike against the United States by Japan at the beginning of World War II to try and take away our ability to project power into the Pacific area. But it psychologically, it absolutely impacted our nation's ability to feel like we were safe and dependent. That morning of 9/11, and this is why I stress when it comes to national security, it is the foundation for everything. A lot of people want to talk about the economy and all that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, on 9/11, nobody cared about their stock portfolio. They didn't care about the traffic going into work. They didn't care about the heated discussion they had with their boss. The morning of 9/11, the people of the United States cared about two things. Is my nation safe? and is my family safe? And without national security, you don't have much. And I will tell you, it was kind of a, in a little unique twist, is that the morning of, well, when I came back to Washington, D.C. following Cole, I had an opportunity to go up to the CIA and get briefed by them on what went on about the attack on my ship. And at the end of that briefing, the assistant director, great American named Charlie Allen, said, "What do you think?" I thanked him, and then I said, "Sir, I have to be honest with you. America doesn't understand. I believe it is going to take a seminal event, probably in this country, where hundreds if not thousands die before Americans realize we're at war with this guy," meaning bin Laden. 20 minutes after I made that statement, the first plane hit the North Tower. It was the morning of 9/11. I watched as the second plane hit. I then ended up down just outside the Pentagon on the main north-south artery going in and out of DC 395 near what's called Boundary Channel Drive. And I sat there with Arlington Police, Virginia State Highway Patrol, and for the next 6 hours helped direct traffic, and families picked up their little kids from the daycare center that was attached to the Pentagon. But when it comes to 9/11, all those lives lost should not be in vain. They should teach our nation that we cannot let these actions by whether it's terrorists or drug cartels or other governments to go unanswered. So consequently, with 100,000 Americans dead because of an open and porous border to our south, our nation needs to begin to take proactive steps to engage the government of Mexico and say, "We can help you solve the problem, but you're going to solve this problem, or we are going to get involved in a way you may not like in order for us to keep our country safe."
On that particular point, I still remember when I served in the Bush administration after 9/11, and the global war on terrorism was the phrase. We were focused on building, and you mentioned the new Department of Homeland Security, the new Transportation and Security Administration. We were focused on building capabilities, and our capabilities in our government had to be better than the adversary, had to be better than the terrorists. And we had a mantra: it takes a network to defeat a network, if you remembered that our network had to be better. Our governance had to be better to basically reduce risk against terrorist attacks. So what you're saying again is that it really all doesn't matter. You know, looking at the Cole lesson, the 9/11 lessons, and thinking of the adversary, is our nation safe? Are our families safe? And that national security is the fundamental key interest of the government to protect the citizens of the United States, and our networks, our capabilities in our Homeland Security Department, Customs and Border Protection, DEA, the Naval Service, etc. They all have to be as good as they could be with our technology, with our people in particular, with our families. So you're making a critically important point. It all boils down to that, doesn't it, Kurt?
It really does. And I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, you're summarizing what we've had in the discussion over the last hour, in that we as a nation cannot afford not to react to the threats that we are seeing. We cannot afford to allow the threat to metastasize into concrete actions that affect our citizens, that affect our government, that affect our nation and its ability to defend itself. We have to begin to start being proactive again. And we are watching this in China, in how they're reacting in the South China Sea. Mm-hmm. We are seeing this on our southern border, up close and personal. We are seeing what's going on, and I know there's a lot of discussions going on with respect to Russia, but when you look at it, look at what happened with Russia over years. They have been engaged, starting with the invasion into Georgia, the destabilization into the Nagorno-Karabakh region between Armenia and Azerbaijan. When you look at what Russia has also done in invading Crimea in 2014, and what was the U.S. response to all of those? Virtually nothing. Put maybe a few little sanctions in place, and that was about it. The approach to Russia has been like the approach to Al-Qaeda. And if we allow Ukraine to fall, it is going to be giving, like Al-Qaeda, the green light. It is going to be giving Russia the green light to move ahead. But it's also sending an important signal to China, and it's also going to be sending an important signal to the drug cartels that the United States is unwilling to stand up and fight for their citizens and our own national security. And at that point, we are going to be dangerously vulnerable, even though we may have the best young men and women serving in our military and the best equipment available to defend us.
Those are very powerful insights, and certainly we've got, I think, the right listeners out there that are taking these particular points aboard with regard to our national security and what's important. There are certainly opportunities to communicate politically with some leadership here in Arizona. We've got our two senators representing Arizona there on the Hill, and also in our House delegations on the Hill. So in summary, and our time's getting short, unfortunately, Kirk, what would you communicate to try to get that spirit back like we had, from your ship, and that focus on force protection, because really it's our own country's protection now. What do we have to reaffirm to get national security back on top as the key interest of the United States to properly build our capabilities?
I think it's going to be twofold. From the top, we demand that our elected leaders be held accountable for the decisions they make, and that there is their responsibility to ensure that we as citizens are informed about what's going on so that we can make the best decision on what we should be doing for our national security interests. And from the bottom up, I believe it is incumbent upon every American to start realizing that there is only one person in your life responsible for the decisions you make and the consequences that come from it, and that's you as an individual. Taking on that mantle of personal responsibility, it has an infectious effect on everyone around you, and they begin to realize that you're a person that they can trust, that they can believe in, and that will do what's right, and that you, in fact, can also trust your neighbors as well. So it has to be a twofold process, and with that, I think that national security will naturally flow from that, but we have to demand accountability from our elected leaders.
Well, Kirk, my shipmate, Captain Kirk, I salute you, sir, and again, many thanks for taking the time today to really spend almost a full hour to communicate the importance of your time on the USS Cole to honor still the memories of our fallen citizens and shipmates over the course of the last 23 years since Cole and beyond. We hope to see you soon in person as we head into the fall, and truly appreciate you calling today, sir.
Absolutely, Bob. It's been my pleasure. Thank you for your service and leadership when you had command of your ships as well, because those young men and women who choose a life of consequence and service to our nation are what matter.
Thank you. That's going to do it for our time together.
Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. What other kind of customers do you have?
So our biggest customers are actually like ranchers and people from outside of the Tucson area. They're buying a lot of square tubing. They're buying a lot of stuff for their ranch to close off fences.
We'll sell anything from 10 feet to 10,000 feet to somebody that comes in, because we have new steel and surplus steel from steel mills. The reason we're able to get such good pricing on some of this stuff is, A, we sell scrap to the mill. So we have a relationship there, and then we can buy material what they're making, bringing it back. And so we save on freight, and we have relationships for years with them. So I think that's really our niche market. We'll sell whatever you need.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
Perfection Theater presents Snow White.
Mirror, mirror on the wall, who has the sweetest ride of them all?
It once was you, but Snow White has a Maserati that's now the fairest and the fastest.
I will put an end to that.
The Evil Queen drove over to Snow White's cottage in her Ferrari F40.
I will finish her off once and for all.
The Evil Queen poured apple cider vinegar in her gas tank.
Can you dwarves help me? I need a push to Perfection Auto Works.
The Perfection mechanics cleaned the fuel lines and Snow White was back on the road in no time. Snow White had had enough, so she headed to the Evil Queen's castle.
Pour apple cider vinegar in my gas tank. Why, I'll show you.
And the moral of the story? Perfection Auto Works is always there to make your automotive repairs come true. 323-8650 and perfectionautoworks.com.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. When people turn 50, something miraculous happens. They start to get serious about retirement planning. They've done very well so far and want to be certain they power into the retirement they've earned. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.